Welcome to the Green Alliance podcast. We are the charity and think tank that is all about achieving ambitious leadership for the environment. This episode was recorded 2 days after the US election at an event in which we brought together a panel of experts to discuss what the outcome means for climate and nature.
These values, we should be, you know, just selling left, right, and center of, you know, clean air, clean water, healthier, more inclusive, more vibrant communities that actually sustain us rather than diminish us.
The discussion was chaired by Jess Shankelman, reporter for Bloomberg News, and our panel was made up of Claire Healy, Director of Climate Diplomacy at the environmental think tank E3G, Brendan Guy, Senior Advisor at the NRDC Action Fund, and Executive Director of Future Coalition, Kate Eder. Here is Jess.
Biden has pledged to immediately rejoin the Paris Agreement and launch a $2 trillion climate and green recovery plan, which would effectively reverse many of the actions of Trump over the last 4 years. Having said that, even if Biden doesn't claim victory today, what we haven't seen is a strong blue wave that some polls show would have given Democrats control of both houses in Congress. So we're going to chat about that a bit today. I'm going to start with Claire. What does what we know so far about the election outcome mean for global climate politics overall? What's the key threats and opportunities as you see them?
Number one, like big picture, President Biden, we know he's a known character. We know A, he believes in science, B, he believes in multilateralism, and C, he's made climate and climate ambition a central theme of his campaign, right? So I think not only would he rejoin, I think it just opens a space for more multilateralism and cooperation. The question then becomes, how do we use that space? And so on climate, there are three things, I think. One, Paris and the formal climate diplomatic processes. So yes, we would expect him to rejoin, would expect a new NDC at some point during the year. That NDC has to be ambitious as possible. It also has to be credible. So this is where we get with the connection with the domestic policy. And I know Brendan's going to say more about that, how credible that needs to be. There will also be a long-term commitment to net zero by 2050. So the US will join that club and the race to net zero. And then the other point is, in terms of multilateralism and cooperation, is, you know, the pandemic. The virus is still raging. Just yesterday, cases exceeded 100,000 in the US. On election day, 1,100 Americans died from COVID-19. So this is a reality. And so I think if President Biden would also look to cooperate with countries and figure out how, A, we get, you know, share information, develop a vaccine, get this pandemic under control. And two, how we do, as he said, his transition website is called Build Back Better. And I think he would take that also globally and have that conversation. How do we recover? And I think green recovery is still on the agenda internationally and also domestically. So I do think there are lots of possibilities. I'm not sort of Panglossian about what can be achieved. I'm sure this will come out in the discussion. But being pragmatic, there's lots that we can do. And foreign policy is one area where a President Biden and a Biden administration would have more freedom. So we would expect him and his administration to lean in on climate. And that's good news.
What does it mean for COP26? That's the next big global climate event, this time next year. The UK is the president. What will the UK as the host country be thinking about at this point in time?
So with COP26, I think, again, we've got to take a broader perspective, like climate ambition. We need to see 2020 and 2021, this is the year we've got to set up for deep decarbonization. So the COP26, I think, is not just an event on the diplomatic calendar. It is a window to the next decade.
Brendan, I want to ask you about domestic policy. Claire talked about the net zero target that Biden has said that he would set. How does he do that? How does he set a net zero, 2050 net zero target, and when?
So I think in terms of getting on a trajectory to net zero, of course, that is going to require legislation. There's no way to get on track for net zero without legislation. So some of those efforts are not going to be as accelerated as President Biden might have hoped. But I think there's still a lot that he can do to really start pushing that agenda forward actually quite quickly, even from day one. even just with current executive authority that he has. And I think you've heard him say this on the campaign trail and would probably translate to him being president. You know, climate change is a priority. And I think even especially now, it's going to be linked with other priorities such as clean infrastructure, clean, good paying jobs, you know, social and racial equity, those types of issues. But I think, you know, he's not going to take his foot off the gas on putting that forward, even if, you know, his tools are slightly different. So what would that actually look like beyond just restoring some of the Trump rollbacks, which is kind of an obvious no-brainer, and really orchestrating a whole of government approach to the climate crisis? I think you'd see action in a couple of different key areas in terms of executive action from President Biden. So that can include things like methane standards for new oil and gas operations. That could include things like energy efficiency standards for buildings, appliances. That could include things like corporate risk disclosure requirements, and that could also include things such as clean power plant and clean car standards. Obviously, those have to be crafted in a way that can withstand legal challenges from a more conservative judicial branch, especially the Supreme Court. But I think you'll see them really looking at every single possible lever that they can be pulling to try and advance action towards that net zero trajectory, because he does know that, you know, we have to be aligning with the science. We have to be listening to the science, not just on COVID-19 and the health pandemic, but obviously on climate. And I think he and his team do get that. So as much as they can be pulling some of those levers to try and, you know, bend the curve down towards net zero, I think they will.
What does the narrative become for the Republican Party for the next 4 years on climate change?
Yeah, I think it's an open question. I mean, if they do retain the Senate, I think they will feel, you know, slightly emboldened. But I don't think that's going to necessarily constrain some potential areas for cooperation. I think you have seen a lot of shifts in the, not necessarily in the political apparatus of the Republican Party, but in the Republican Party kind of writ large itself. So, for example, Republican younger voters are really starting to push some of the politicians on climate and energy issues. I think you saw that even in this election was some Republican candidates starting to position themselves to be able to be more constructive on the issue. And I think in 2022, there's going to be an even more difficult Senate race for Republicans with a lot of more vulnerable senators who are up. And I think you're going to see a lot of pressure to come to the table, just given the popularity of clean energy issues. You know, it's polling, again, who knows how much exactly we can trust polls these days, but I think, you know, it's pretty broadly accepted that, you know, well over 2/3 of the younger Republican voters and even some independents have strong support for transitioning towards clean energy. So I think you will see them start to feel that pressure a lot more, and as especially as they're thinking about trying to maintain their seats in a 2022 election, I think that will be able to bring them to the table on some of these issues a lot more and provide some leverage points. But again, still, it's not going to be a total see the light moment where they turn around and realize the error of their ways. But I think, you know, some of this building pressure, especially from the Republican grassroots and from others, I think will hopefully provide some creative opportunities.
And so I use the opportunity talking about young people to turn to Katie. So there's no doubt it's been a rough couple of years for the grassroots climate movement. How are you feeling today about what's happening? What gives you hope? And what do you see as the major battlegrounds in the weeks and months ahead?
Across the board, we're really glad that young people showed up. And I think looking at sort of moving forward, it gives me a lot of hope to know that as our generation sort of transitions to sort of become older and sort of take more of the sort of traditional places of leadership and power, that we'll be able to see a more progressive agenda across the board, especially on climate. And so sort of the conversations that the youth movement is sort of having these last 2 days is really around sort of this long-term strategy and how we're going to implement it, you know, really running young people across the board, you know, elections in 2022 and beyond. And so I think it's very exciting that we saw this kind of turnout from young people and young people were engaged in the process in this way. I think at the same time, you know, I think where there is fear and where there, you know, the kind of opposite side of that coin is that while we can sort of look to this long-term strategy to sort of bring the U.S. back to sort of being a hopefully progressive leader on the global stage, that when it comes to climate, we just don't have that kind of time. We don't have the time to wait for sort of this generation to take that and claim that power and that leadership sort of in Washington, D.C. And so I think that the sort of claiming of power is going to really need to be seen seen on the streets. And I think that's what we're expecting to do. Our movement has really pushed Biden. Biden ran on the most progressive climate policy plan that we've seen, much of it based off the Green New Deal, which is the framework that the youth movement has really sort of championed in the U.S. So I think in many ways we're hopeful for a Biden administration and to be able to push Biden as far as we can go. The role of young people going forward, I think, is really going to be to follow up our voting in the streets. And that's exactly what folks are prepared to do. And I'm really excited to see how that goes. And I think that, you know, a sort of big key strategy in what we're thinking is expanding our targets right now. So much of our work has been focused on this election, has been focused on sort of the political pillar that's upholding the fossil fuel industry. And I think expanding into the financial space and expanding our targets to villainizing folks that are enabling the fossil fuel industry in other ways, and also highlighting the government's role in sort of enabling the finance industry in upholding the fossil fuel industry. So I think that there's sort of a lot of plays and a lot of angles that allow us to sort of expand our energy on the streets.
So you mentioned President Biden, you push him to go further. Where would you push him to go further, and where would you cut in some slack?
That's a really great question. I mean, I think that, you know, Biden and his administration would serve as an opportunity to be a leader on the global stage. I think that, you know, what we saw sort of during the Obama administration, as much as we didn't see the kind of climate policy I think we could have given the control that we had at that point in time, I think we saw real leadership when it came to the Paris negotiations. My guess is John Kerry, who played a key pivotal role in that, will play a role in the administration around Biden's climate work as well. And so I think what we'll see is a lot of players that served as leader sort of 4 years ago, coming back within the Biden administration. I think that there's a number, you know, Biden himself, and there's actually a really great website, I believe it's climatepresident.org, which goes through all of the different steps that as the executive action that Biden could take day one, that would sort of without Congress of the action that he could take. And so I think we'll definitely be pushing Biden on that executive action. And then I think we'll be, you know, pushing on just the, I think across the board, even if we don't have majority, pushing Biden and the other Democratic leadership in the House and in the Senate on their policy. So when there are open windows to pass legislation, that we'll be able to push as bold legislation as we can.
I want to go back just to talk about the UK, because I know a lot of our audience are based in the UK. A Biden administration could have quite big implications for the future of a trade deal with the US, as the UK is hoping to get after Brexit. What do you think the implications are, particularly in terms of climate, Brendan?
Yeah, so trade politics is likely to be very, very challenging given the current composition of Congress, and especially more so if there is a Republican-controlled Senate. It's pretty hard to imagine any GOP senator supporting anything that could be called, you know, potential tax increase or constraining US energy exports. So I think it is going to be, you know, difficult on the trade front for sure to try and incorporate climate into that, as Biden had been, you know, promoting and hoping for during the campaign. I think in terms of UK-US trade deal specifically, I think clearly there's going to be not a lot of bandwidth for a number of priorities in the early days of the administration. So where that kind of shakes out, given everything they're going to have to do and how much effort they're going to be having to put into, you know, dealing with potentially a kind of unruly or uncooperative Congress. Who knows? Hard to tell. I guess the kind of main thing is just the time frame is very, very tight. So I think it's the early April 2nd deadline to complete a UK-US trade deal in order to sign it before the kind of fast track authority expires in July is very quick to try and turn a trade deal around. That fast track authority basically allows you know, an up or down vote in Congress. Congress can't amend it. They can't kind of do anything with it. It's, you know, do we like this or do we not like this? But then that expires in July of next year. So if you don't have that kind of fast track authority, you know, you could just imagine every single interest group piling every single one of their priorities into one of these trade deals and it just never going anywhere. So I think probably one of the biggest things is, you know, if you're not able to get it done by that early April deadline, the big question then becomes is this trade, fast track trade promotion authority, is that extended if there's a Republican Senate, which could be, but it also could be bogged down for a long time as well too. And again, if you don't have that fast track authority, I don't think many trade deals are going very, very far, very fast. It could take a little while.
And Claire, in terms of thinking about Brexit, I guess climate at the moment is one area where the UK is actually looking not too bad. I mean, we're not dealing that well with the COVID crisis. We're, you know, the Brexit negotiations are really like coming down to a nail biting end. Could a Biden win slightly undermine the UK's status in terms of climate diplomacy? If, you know, if Biden comes in and is able to kind of lead the way, does that make the UK suddenly look quite small in all of this?
Yes. Biden, I think, was obviously came out very early, very strong against Brexit being a good idea, right? Prime Minister Johnson, I think, generally in the US, is seen as being very close to President Trump. But the UK is a good ally and partner to the US, always has been, and so is Europe. So I think the UK with Europe post-Brexit, even if it is more polarized, slightly constrained, I think a US Biden administration, I think, will lean a lot on Europe and the UK to sort of get a lot done on the international stage again, because there is a pandemic raging. Countries are like potentially could default, right? So I do think, again, the UK, we've got to think broader than COP26. They're leading the G7. We need an awful lot of action in the G7 on finance. Again, one of your listeners in the chat talked about the debt issue, right? So on finance, a lot could be done, right? In terms of finding new financing to support recovery. The fiscal space issue, again, that's universal across developed countries and developing countries and emerging markets. There's a lot of space there that a US administration under President Biden with the UK and Europe could actually advance some genuine solutions. And again, and underneath all of that, mainstreaming climate throughout, right? So I do think there's a lot in the next 18 months that we could work with UK hosting those presidencies, with the Biden administration and Europe, we could make a lot of progress.
If you're villainizing the fossil fuel industry, what's the youth movement's proposition for ensuring that those people who have jobs in those industries don't get left, you know, unemployed and even more resentful than they might already be?
That is the question, right? Is how do we approach this from a pathway that is going to happen in a just way? It's going to create new good paying union jobs. It's really a question of this narrative and this story. I mean, it is very clear that the U.S. buys into narrative and story over, you know, anything else. If this election tells us one thing, is that what we've believed to be true is not fact at all. It's just the story that we've been telling ourselves. And so I think this really goes to show how powerful story, how powerful narrative it is. And if we're telling the story that, you know, it's not the fossil fuel industry, you know, it's not folks that are working in the fossil fuel industry across the board, it's folks that have the power to make changes. And that's who sits at the top. Again, it's not just the fossil fuel industry itself, but it's also the enablers of the fossil fuel industry, right? And it's banks for financing fossil fuel projects, it's institutions for continuing to invest in fossil fuels. And those folks, again, it's, you know, it's not folks that are working at the bank branches, it's, you know, the folks who are really at the top that are able to make those decisions and able to make that action, you know, even quite faster than we would be able to see from the government. So much of this is going to be is what is the story that we come out of the gate with, and what is the narrative that we're telling people and that we're telling the rest of the world. And I think if we can set ourselves up in a way that's going to offer an opportunity for the Biden administration and for, you know, I think government players as a whole to act in that hero position and to sort of help move the needle, but doing so in a way that's going to really push it through an environmental justice lens, that's going to really push it through a just transition lens, I think is going to be really key across the board.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on that, actually. Those are really, really excellent points that Katie just made. So two things to follow up on that. On the fossil fuel side, kind of more on the policy side first, and I'll go to the narrative side. Biden made a commitment during the campaign to seek a G20 commitment to phase out fossil fuel subsidies through the G20. This had been a commitment during the G7, during President Obama, obviously had not been realized or acted on. I think the domestic agenda is going to be, there's some things he can do under, you know, existing authority. Obviously, you know, would like to have more that he can do through Congress. But I think on the international side, there's definitely a lot of room to kind of take that agenda and move forward with it. So there's a lot he can do to, you know, restrict, for example, coal financing through multilateral, you know, institutions, using the U.S. voice and its votes and its influence at multilateral development banks, including the IMF and others, to really push fossil fuels, not just subsidies, but kind of broader, you know, exports out of the system a lot faster than they would have been otherwise. So I think that's a place where they have a lot of leeway to be able to push that agenda, which is encouraging. And then the second point, to Katie's point as well, too, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the narrative is just so powerful and so important. And I think we often get lost in the policy wonkery details, which is good and important. But I think, again, exactly to what Katie and that the whole youth movement are doing is building this power of these values that should be, we should be, you know, just selling left, right, and center of, you know, clean air, clean water, healthier, more inclusive, more vibrant communities that actually sustain us rather than diminish us and you know, pollute communities. So I think all those things, you know, it's obviously they're winning issues, or they should be winning issues. And I think we just need to be a lot better at creating those narratives and telling those stories. And I think the youth movement is certainly leading the charge on that. So we all need to kind of lean into that a little bit more rather than just spending all of our time figuring out the wonky policy details.
Katie, I'd be interested to hear your view on this debate about, you know, do the Democrats go down a kind of no-holds-barred approach or take a more compromising approach, particularly because you were saying the evolution of the youth climate movement is to run for seats in the Senate. Does that mean that eventually you do have to accept some level of compromise?
I think that what the youth movement has that's sort of in our advantage is that there are, as Brendan said, you know, there's a number of young leaders in the Conservative Party that are climate champions, that are really, you know, strong advocates for their party to take action when it comes to climate. I think the other thing that's playing in our favor more so than when Obama was in office is that the fossil fuel industry is a dying industry now. You know, it is not as lucrative and successful as it has been in the past. And so I think that there are going to be windows of opportunity for Republicans to see opportunities with renewables, with a transition to a green economy. And so I do think that there are opportunities for bipartisanship. And I think as much as Biden was not the pick for the youth movement, I think that, you know, he's potentially in a very strong position to sort of play that role of bringing some of the folks from the right to sort of be stronger champions on climate. And then I think the other thing is really, you know, analyzing our strategy as a movement of, you know, how we're talking to, you know, Democrats versus Republicans. I mean, I think that there's been a lot of criticism, rightfully so, you know, in my opinion, around the youth movement and how we villainized members of the Democratic Party leadership as far as with their inaction on climate, rather than sort of targeting Republican leadership and doing it potentially in a more strategic way. You know, we're talking, just joking around with some of my colleagues yesterday, is that, you know, Lindsey Graham has grandchildren, Mitch McConnell has grandchildren, and those young people probably are very interested in seeing climate solutions. And so why are we not talking to them? You know, why are we not appealing to them to sort of work sort of more of an inside game, to sort of move that sort of that older generation to a place where they're feeling strong about climate? There is actually a lot of sort of windows of opportunity, you know, with Biden in the administration to sort of expand what we're looking at when it comes to climate policy. And the last thing I'll say again is going back to this sort of looking at this financial pillar and how that's continuing to enable and hold up the fossil fuel industry. And working on a strategy that's really sort of turning our forces toward them and villainizing them. And I think that really kind of provides a whole different narrative again and a different pathway toward not only getting Republican Party leadership to potentially sort of fall in line and potentially do more bold action when it comes to climate, but I think when it comes to Democratic leadership as well, we could potentially see, you know, more movement in thinking about who we're villainizing and sort of thinking about where we're turning our movement energy toward.
Thank you for listening to this Green Alliance podcast. Keep checking in as we will continue to bring you specialist interviews and highlights from our events here on the podcast. You can subscribe to the Green Alliance podcast on your favourite podcast app, and you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter at Green Alliance UK.